Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Susan Shaw Saylor. After retiring from the Department of English at West Virginia University, where she taught 20th century Irish and British literature, Susan Shaw Saylor completed an MFA in the Low Residency Program in Poetry at New England College in 2007. Her poems have appeared in journals such as Poetry East, Kestrel, 5 a.m., and Pearl. Her chapbook, entitled Coal, was published in 2012 by Finishing Line Press. Her full-length book, Ship of Light, was published by Port Yonder Press in 2013, and her reviews and articles about poetry have appeared in Indiana Review, Prairie Schooner, and Ale House Review. Saylor lives in Morgantown, West Virginia. Hi, Susan, how are you?
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you here. So you're going to read from a couple of your books today.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would like to start with four poems from Cole about the 2006 Sago mine disaster. 13 men were in the mine at the point, and of those 13, 12 died. 11 miners. Blackest black beyond the glow of cap lights, choking dust, boulders on rails. The man trip can't go out. They hang the barricade against CO. Fumble with air packs, each worth an hour's oxygen. They don't speak or move. That uses up good air. They sit, breathe slow. One man recalls his hunting dog dead 10 years, the way she'd point a pheasant, flush a grouse. Another sees his baby daughter stumble, grab the sofa, steady herself, step out. He feels dizzy, grabs the air pack. Damn it, my pack ain't working right. Don't swear God hears us. Hey, mine don't either. Or mine. They move to share. A watch face shows 40 minutes gone. Dear God, let them find us soon. The youngest wonders, could his wife be pregnant from last night? The oldest hopes his wife won't find his gambling debt. He planned to pay it off next week. One guy wishes he had a smoke. He sees his camel's dashboard of his Ford. Roof rumbles. Rescuers? They pound the ceiling, scream, shout, sit, wait. Coal and rock dust coats their lips, lashes, stops their ears. Damn dust! Beer would be good. They should hear drilling. Two pray, all join in. Heavenly Father, have mercy on me. One man traces letters in the dust. J-E-S-U-S-S. A. 12 men died at the explosion, but after about 3 or 4 months had passed, more men died, and that was through suicide. The title of this poem is Photograph Sago Mine Worker. He did it right, one for the dog, one for him. She died quick, hips so far gone, she couldn't hardly walk. He took longer. It started with investigators, all the questions. What were the CO readings that morning? A little high, but the foreman didn't cancel the crew. Where's the log, they asked. How could those records get lost? When the mine exploded, he lost more than the log. Felt like they blamed him. It wasn't him. It was the lightning. Everybody knows that. Told me when his head hit the pillow, all's he'd see, his buddy sitting there, air smoky, foul, waiting to die. Said it got so bad when he'd go to 7-Eleven to buy cigarettes. The clerk never looked him in the eye. Wasn't you, I told him. You was lucky they wasn't. We never talked about it, us guys who got out. He felt like we stayed away from him. Now he's there, face where he never wanted it to be. Page 1. Miner takes life. He didn't take life, he took death. Day before last, when I was driving home, I saw a sign. Mouse dangling from a red hawk's talons, swinging forward, swinging back as the hawk flew. That was him, that mouse. The doubt, it was the hawk. Caught him hard as the hawk got the mouse. He went home, put 2 bullets in his .45. If you got any feelings for him, burn that photo. It wasn't him. And the one survivor, when he was taken out of the mine, He was basically 99% dead. He did recover. There is quite a lot of brain impairment and some other problems. But this poem is titled Survivor's Wife. She hasn't left him for 9 days, the boy, the baby at her sister's. Doctors put him in a coma to save his brain. Maybe they'll bring him out next week. He's locked in manacles, IV drip for food, oxygen, urethra drain, breathing machine. Disinfectants in the ward remind her how he smelled tangy sharp when he drove home from showering at the mine, how he put Junior on his back, kicked like a mule till Junior rode him to his stall under the table. She hums, "My love's a river, source underground, always flows, never stops, a diamond so hard it will not chip or break." Outside the window, snowflakes drift as if they have no place to go. She remembers their beginning in eighth grade. She sat in front of him, liked how he knew birds' names, explained algebra better than Miss Vincent. She shivers, lifts the sweatshirt hood over her head, tugs the sleeves to her fingertips. "Look, Anna," he'd said, walking home from church. He'd seen it through the mist, sleeping in an oak. "A great horned owl." She followed his finger, saw it large and still, tufted ears just visible, a slightly darker gray than the limb on which it sat.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Susan Shaw Sailor. She's reading from her chapbook entitled Coal. Susan, I wanted to ask you about the process of writing poems related to historical events. And I know you've written all kinds of poems, but this chapbook, Coal, has to do with the Sego mine disaster. And can you talk about that, if your writing process is different, and how, when you're writing about, you know, a disaster, how to manage the historical facts and how to, what other considerations you have to, you know, think about?
Well, I should begin by saying I did not have any relationship to coal. None of my family were miners or had anything to do with mining. So I was completely outside mining. But the second semester I was in residency at an MFA program, Sego blew up, and I was in New Hampshire, and people were asking me what happened, because since I was from West Virginia, I should have known, but I'd been on the plane all day and so knew nothing. And they began bringing me articles from the New York Times and other newspapers. And the more I read, the more I felt probably this explosion shouldn't have happened, that some carelessness was involved. And I began to feel like I had some kind of commitment to find out more and to write about it, because those men died and shouldn't have died. So I had to find out a lot. I collected probably several hundred newspaper articles and probably a few dozen magazine articles. I researched the internet for the official investigators' reports of Sego. And I finally began to feel that I knew enough that I had some right to write about it, although since I was outside the coal community, that didn't quite feel right either. And I went to Sego, the actual tiny village. It's just so small. And spent some time walking around the village, but I couldn't get anywhere close to the mine because there were fences and guards with pistols, and they were saying things like, "Get back in your car, don't take any photographs." So I returned home and wrote poems and hoped that I was not trampling on other people's lives, but I wanted to pay respect to that community. Mm-hmm. The community was so grief-stricken, and those men were gone forever. Mm-hmm.
That sounds like it took a long time to get to these poems, even before you started writing.
Well, I made the mistake of starting to write too quickly, but I had to throw those away.
Oh, okay. Did your feelings relating to being an outsider, being West Virginia, and your relationship to to the tragedy shift at all during the writing or after the writing?
Well, in kind of a roundabout way, here's the answer. The first time I went to Sago, before I'd even walked into any building, I was so overcome. I swear the grief was just in the air. And I breathed it for about 5 minutes and knew I had to get out of there. I just couldn't take it and then cried all the way home. And then maybe 6 weeks later, I went back and it was still pretty hard, but I really wanted to be in that church where people had gathered and walk around and just try to be part of it. And in some ways, I that helped, being closer to the event itself. Mm-hmm. And then I actually met, he was a trustee of the Sago Baptist Church, and he talked at quite at length about what it had been like that day. Mm-hmm. And the 2 days afterwards.
Mm-hmm. It sounds really clear that your intention was to honor the men and,
oh, definitely.
And the people there.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. These come from my book, Ship of Light. Even though I'm 74, at one point I was a girl, and this is about when I was a girl. When I was 10, I walked on down trees that lay against the riverbank, torn from earth by winter winds, spring floods, stripped of bark and limbs. I sought those that spanned the river, roots embedded in the nearer bank, top held by gravel in the other. I mounted the root end, stepped goat foot along the trunk to midpoint, where the Nisqually raced below in glacial melt. Queen of logs, I surveyed the river as it tore downstream. That was set in the Pacific Northwest, near Mount Rainier. I grew up somewhat close to that. I have never been in Tuscaloosa, but that city is in the title of the next poem, Dancing in Tuscaloosa, where stars wear hazy halos and night steam. You lose your sense of how things are, air heavy with magnolias and sweat. You think twice before chewing hemlock leaves, before edging toward the ends of rooftops. You thought the Statue of Liberty signified? Does the Constitution speak to you? Don't save your high heels waiting. Don't lose the rhythm where the band goes home. Recall the bite of Cajun corn dogs, the savage thrill of carnival. When the gig ends and the saxophonist leans on high C until his breath is gone, and so is yours. Take out your inhaler, prime it, pump it up, dance into the muggy dawn. You would think at my age that I had probably had a lot of pedicures, but I haven't. My first one occurred when I was 71. My granddaughter, 13, paints my toenails. She started with an avocado lemon foot soak, then a lower foot and leg massage. When she has buffed my toenails smooth, she takes out 30 polishes. I choose pearly purple. 4 coats later, she judges me done, my ordinary feet transformed. After 6 weeks, the polish on my left big toenail and right fourth toenail cracks, begins to peel. The other 8, the toes of a goddess. Until a couple of years ago, I lived in a tiny community called Rock Lake that was located right next to a state park. And in that state park, there were a number of trails, one of them Wild Turkey Trail, and that shows up in the title of this poem, Ice Storm, Wild Turkey Trail. Add another sweater when coal steals in. That's marrow cold. Fingers too whitely stiff to play the piano cold. Plug in the oil heater when frost paints ferns on windows, fronds arabesquing as you watch. Tree limbs encased in ice split, crack, drop. By morning they lie broken in sun, your eyes delighted and defied by the million facets. On the hill behind the house, a raccoon carries her kits one by one to a new hollow. The sun undoes some of the cold's work, leaves the rest as evidence. A few years ago, the husband of one of my dearest friends died, and he gave so much to the world. I wrote this poem in honor of him, lighting the candles. Take life, take death, take in a breath, praise his life. See the man at noon, praise the man at noon before shadows lengthened. The shadows that lengthened, darkening, why did they come to him? Where did they find his name? Who isn't lessened, losing him? Imagine if he'd had more time. Imagine he'd had less. Praise his life, a sturdy shelter for climbers, a luminous four-season garden. He seized life, death took him. Commend his name.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Susan Shaw Sailor. And she's reading from her new book of poems, Ship of Light. Susan, it seems like place is a huge factor in your poems, you know, whether it's from your chapbook, Cole, related to the Sago mine disaster, or, you know, even in the poems you've just read related to Rock Lake, Tuscaloosa, you know. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to place, how it figures into your work?
Well, I should begin by saying that I'm not a native West Virginian. People who are born in West Virginia would not consider me a West Virginian at all. I will always be a transplant. I grew up in Washington State. But I ended up in West Virginia because I applied for a faculty position at West Virginia University, and I had an on-campus interview. It was something like February 2nd, and an ice storm had hit Morgantown, and the roads were just treacherous, and the department chair met me at the airport and told me to watch my step as we left the airport because the ice really was bad. And the moment I stepped out of the airport and onto West Virginia soil, it was like I'd come home for the first time ever. And even though I lived in Washington State for more years than I will ever be able to live in West Virginia, that was never home somehow. And West Virginia is. When I finished my degree at the University of Washington, faculty there said, do not go to West Virginia, you are going to hate it. So I surprised them. And I consider myself a West Virginian.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you see that affecting your writing process, or, you know, a lot of place does get into your work?
Well, I guess, you know, I have a body, and that body lives in particular spaces. And I guess the poems I write don't feel to me as though they're abstracted from walking on ground and looking at birds and petting my dog. And so it just seems natural when I begin to write a poem that I remember the place, and it gives me some kind of energy, of feeling to carry on thinking, writing the poem.
Mm-hmm. It also seems to me that it functions as a sort of grounding force in your work, that, you know, we always seem to know where we are in your poems, and that's a great thing. Another thing that I noticed is there seems to be an element of praise in your work, you know, whether it's direct or not. You know, for the miners, you read a poem for a friend who had died, but it seems like there's a lot of praise going on for just the world. Do you think that's accurate about your work?
Yeah, I do. However, if you read any of my poems written in my 20s and 30s, they would not be. As I've gotten older, I am more grateful every day for just being alive, and I think my poems probably reflect that. I have no idea how much time I have left, but I'm going to love all of it.
Okay. Okay, can you read some more?
Sure. All during my life, people have noted that I don't take good photographs. And this is a poem about not taking good photographs. "You don't take good photographs," he said. "Your facial bones are wrong. Tilt your head down. To the right. More, more. Slight smile. Hold. Relax. When people take your photo, tell them, shoot your left profile. The right's your bad side." Other bads. "I can't read maps. Can't tell north from east. Colorblind, so red looks brown. Right ear nearly deaf. Left breast larger than the right. So nearsighted, I'll never be far. Words inscribe me. Think triple rainbows, the 53 varieties of marble, the water drop that sways at a pine needle tip, sways, elongates, falls." For a long time, but especially since menopause, I've had a hard time falling asleep, and I have quite a few poems about that subject. This is one of those. "Before sleep, I think of Darwin. At the dinner party, Darwin says to Noah, 'What about the pterodactyl?' Noah says, 'Just ran out of time.' A green light pulses in the mirror, the CO counter. After 200 pulses, I stop counting. Now Darwin has me thinking, I can't remember how to do cube roots. I hold the image of a candle flame, meditate on emptiness. Inhale, relax, exhale, relax. No coffee, no tea, but still the Darwin influence. Can antimatter be another term for dark matter? I throw off covers, stumble to the living room. Lights on, Rebecca West's Black Lamb and Gray Falcon offers Yugoslavia. Bookmarked page 269, a few hundred more to go." I have spent some time at West Virginia's writer's retreat at Aurora. This poem I wrote there after having taken a walk in Cathedral State Park, which is across the highway, at 70. "Forsythia nearly finished with its yellow, furled leaves of shrubs and scrub trees barely green. Along the gravel road, wind sashays hemlocks, swirls dust where mud has dried in ruts. Cathedral Brook sweeps twigs and blackened leaves toward roots that catch and hold them for a while. Am I young enough to bear the risk of spring? The red oak out my window kept its ghost leaves through the winter, released them when buds swelled. Where the downspout elbows, two robins built their nest."
Susan, can you talk a little bit about how you sort of recommitted or committed yourself to poetry after a whole career and a whole, you know, as an academic? And because I think it's kind of stunning how you did this, where you decided to go back to get an MFA, and now you have a chapbook and a book. And I know there's some women out there listening, and I wonder if you could just briefly tell that story and any kind of words of encouragement you might have for them.
Well, go for it. Where your passion lies, do it. Do it while there's still time. I love being an academic, but I came late to it. When my daughter went away to college, I was desolated and realized how empty my marriage was and had to do something. So I went back to school and got a PhD. And I tried to stay on the West Coast, but universities there wanted people not from the West Coast. So then I hit a job search and ended up at West Virginia University. And academic writing was easy for me, and it was just fine. And then I retired when my tax preparer said I would make as much in retirement as I did working. So that was an easy decision. And I'd been writing poetry all my life, casually. But after retiring, I took a couple of workshops and really enjoyed the process of thinking about poems. Well, what I was writing then I couldn't call art, but I wanted to think more about the process of writing poems and the various ways I could not manipulate the poem, but graft and shape how I was writing. And I was intrigued enough that I really wanted to do this seriously, and so at a fairly late stage in my life, I entered a low residency MFA program, and then Sago happened, so I was writing the Sago poems, and they found their way into publication, and I wanted to keep doing it, and I still do.
Well, I mean, congratulations. You've really done a lot in a short period of time. It's kind of amazing. So we have time for just a couple more.
The poem I'd like to read is Pear. I saw an absolutely ravishing photograph of a pear in National Geographic, and this poem is based on that photograph, Pear. This pear will break your heart if you bite in. Tiny droplets bead the perfect skin. Its juice will taste like spring remembered in late fall, top to bottom yellowing to almost coral. And here you are, an aging, say it, old woman, sucking at sublimity. The curving stem parallels the curve of its right side. Who could have guessed you had it in you? I have a dog that I love. Her name is Loki. And at night, when we were at Rock Lake, I would walk her one last time before we all went to bed. Walking Loki. Bright orange, full March moon, clouds slide across its face. I'm walking Loki last time tonight. The motion sensor clicks, garage light on. 5 minutes later, off. The other moon still covered, faint orange faded to mostly black. 5 stars visible, then one. Loki sniffs for deer. Wind rustles dry oak leaves, swirls them. I am content to be, for now I do not need to see if God shares this dark, good, if not, good. I twist the flashlight on, walk up the drive toward home. Loki stops once more. We enter light. And several years ago, I needed to leave Rock Lake, and this poem commemorates. Leaving Rock Lake. From our cottage on the hill above the dam, I hear Glady Creek cascade over boulders as it tumbles toward the Tigert River. Low over the lake, a flock of Canada geese. In June, 80 feet of wild rhododendrons bloom pale pink after narcissi and daffodil snow show and mountain laurels opening. November through March, ice. Steep driveway, 18 ice-bound stairs, cottage to road. 2 winters ago, ice wedged our back door closed for days. Last October, I stepped on an acorn, fractured a pelvic bone. Last January, my Honda slid on ice in the driveway, stopped just short of the 4-foot bank. Next fall, I won't be at Rock Lake to see 200 trees, oaks, maples, black walnuts, poplars, turn magenta, gold, copper, bronze. What will become of the young red dogwood we protected from deer with rebar and chicken wire? Unresolved. In woods I could not see, a lark began to call as if the world would end in flames. Light rose to hoary heights and did not fall until you laid your hand on my right arm. I said the forecast had not called for rains and turned my face to face the pockmarked wall.
The poetry of Susan Shaw Sailor. Thank you so much, Susan. It was great.
It was fun.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.